Accession number 28759, real 9.
This is probably a good moment just to have a pause, I think, to tease.
Okay.
So you've done your training at Andover, working with...
That's right. That was an OTU, Operational Training Unit.
And you described, I can't remember if we had the tape recorder running or not, but how the jet pilots would buzz you.
Oh.
I don't think we did record it, so perhaps you could tell that story
when
again.
When we flew to Lark Hill, the gun ranges from Andover, we used to go past the aerodrome at... where they're training...
Boscombe Down, you said.
Boscombe Down. And they used to come and fly over the top of us. And you used to be in the sort of backwash of a jet plane. And if you didn't look out, you kept you on your toes there, really, didn't you?
So they were just sort of, it was just a game, I see.
Yes. Well, then there was a lot of training... sort of moving the, working with infantry and gunners, and field exercises, training to go out to the Far East, because that war was still going on against the Japs. And eventually we had the final... exams and so on and so forth, and the wings presentation, and we were fully fledged Aero P pilots. And I was not posted to an Aero P squadron because they were waiting about for the end of the war in the Far East. The arrival of the atomic bomb made that made that decision for us, and so that war was over in the Far East. And then I was posted to the Guards Armored Division in Germany, based at Bad Godesberg, into number 652 Aero P Squadron, where I became a glorified taxi driver for staff and generals in the Armoured Division. I played a lot of rugger and did a lot of flying. We're in Germany, to various divisions.
What were your impressions of being in Germany after... So this is in 1945, towards the end of 1945.
Well, there was a Russian question all the time.
Bad Godesberg, you said. Where is that?
It's on the Rhine. Near Bonn. Cologne, Bonn. And... it was the most southern division, the British forces. Quite an important one because, of course, the administration was organised and started up at Bonn. Came the West German government, and all AMGOT was based there, and was quite an important place. So there was a lot of communication going on and moving about. And so the division was pretty active until it was moved to North Germany, to Kiel. And I stayed with them there. We set up a gliding school at Salzgitter, of which we had various people decided they wanted to go gliding. and a very nice division to work in. I mean, they look after themselves very well. And I used to fly the generals to when they could, they wanted to go to Brussels, and where they were, they could, if their wives were in the armed forces, they could get to Brussels, but they weren't allowed to come to Germany. So I used to fly them to Brussels. And we had quite a good time there, really. And that, when I got demobbed.
So that was the end. Yeah. Your impressions of Germany then after the war, you said, you said earlier, Cologne, you were just amazed at how badly bombed. What were your...
Well,
Bonn wasn't so badly hit, was it, I think?
Bonn, that's why Bonn was made into the administrative headquarters, because it wasn't bombed. At Gettysburg, while the Guards Army Division decided to move division there, had plenty of hotels unscathed. And but Cologne and the other industrial towns in the Ruhr were badly bombed, the railway lines. But of course, Germans soon got organized, clearing up the rubble. You didn't get any rations unless you cleared up the rubble. That was the great thing there. I had a friend who was a town major in the Ruhr, and he was obviously very good, successful, and he's been back several times, got to know the people there. He was in one of the German Ruhr towns. I remember going and to Krupp's, enormous factories, bombed some of it. But the Germans, I remember them saying, and give us a couple of months, we'll have this place running again. And by God, they had. I was amazed at the way they were able to cope and still build the single jet fighters in Italy and underground factories. And they were still on, at Kiel, the sections of U-boats, in sections, still being manufactured, being waited to be connected up into submarines, even with the Russians knocking on the door and everything else. Quite extraordinary. Mind you, it was all compulsory labour. It is.
Slave labour.
Yeah. Lots of people died doing it. Some of these underground factories were, you know, curtains that were like being sent to jail or, you know, prison or anything you like. Death sentence to a lot of them.
So when were you in Germany then? When did you arrive in Germany? In 40...
Well, I arrived in Belgium, first of all, because they didn't know what to do with half the people. And I became a camp commandant to a brigadier, I've forgotten his name. And I remember interviewing him the first day. And he said, "Don't you, you've only got one job here, and that's to look after all my stallions," which he'd purloined from the Germans, "and his enormous number of grooms. So I had to go and find fodder for all these horses and make sure the grooms were looked after." And so the gentleman concerned got his GGs.
What was his name?
I can't remember. We diplomatically.
It doesn't matter. It'd be quite interesting, really.
I've forgotten. I wasn't there very long. He got shifted about all the time. I don't think anybody can make their minds up. They've got so many people who are clamouring to get home or get home abroad or do all kinds of things. It must be a shambles. I mean, in their own regiment, they didn't know what to do with them. And they got them, sent them up to Austria. And my brother was sent with his Lovett scouts to Greece to sort out their problems there, because they with some 4th Indian Division was sent down there to sort out the Greeks. And they're having problems with Aokas, or well, I forget the name of them now. President Makarios wasn't he involved or something?
Indeed. Yes, but that was in Cyprus, surely.
Cyprus, yes.
Anyway, but
that's what was happening. It was an all state of flux.
So, but you arrived then, so you went from Belgium to Germany, and you were there at the end of 1945-ish?
Yes.
And how were you treated by the Germans that you met, the civilians? Did you have much contact with them? Or?
Well, they were all. I mean, I used to hear all about them. We had living in a very nice hotel in Bad Godesberg, and we had fellows who were wanting jobs, ex-army fellows, been wounded. Some of them, you know, wanted jobs. Some of them had been within about 20 miles of Moscow, you know, as far as the army is concerned. And you heard amazing stories about the Germans, how they didn't have the clothing. They froze to death. This business of, well, like, you know, Napoleon went to, the same thing happened to the Germans. They couldn't support the length of between Germany and, well, where was it? Stalingrad. And I don't know how the Germans did it. I mean, they still maintained an enormous army, didn't they?
But I mean, going back to your experience, they were friendly. They fraternized. They needed to be friendly, because I mean, what about the black market? Was there a thriving?
Oh well, that was the thing was in the black market. You see, you the only people who could smoke cigarettes were the farmers, because the currency was cigarettes. And the British Army got cigarettes sent up in the rations. I can never understand. They didn't have to draw any army pay to buy anything, because you had the occupational currency, which you were allowed to change into sterling when you went on leave. And I don't know why the army kept up paying, but they must have thought, that's funny, we've got an enormous army of 1 million men, but they never draw any pay. Or somehow, they're in Germany. I remember we went to Berlin. We motored there. My flight commander was a Rhodesian, Butch Pritchard, in Germany. There were four of us at Bad Godesberg. We flew quite a lot all the time. We flew various people, mostly staff, army staff, I remember there was a Dutch dance band which came and did various shows. And we used to uplift them to get them around Germany more easily. And various things.
A whole dance band in one hostel?
Well, no, this was part of the dance band. They used to have different people doing it.
And there was traffic on the roads. I mean, the country was getting back into one piece.
Yes, not very quickly on the road. There were, you know, the outer bounds needed a lot of repair work. Every bridge was pretty well blown. And of course, the other thing was Helmstedt was the frontier. And then it was 200 miles on the Autobahn from Helmstedt. Because you at Helmstedt, you start in the Russian zone. So it was about under 200 miles into the Berliner Ring. And then, of course, we had all the business of supplying, didn't we, through
the
Air Berlin, Force.
The Berlin, through. Berlin Run. That was, yes. But that was in 47, 48, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just after you left the army. I'm just trying to think of anything else that really struck you about your individual stories of being in Germany as a British pilot, flying people around.
Very easy, because you see, there was no flying, there was no control. I mean, if you wanted to fly to Brussels, you just follow the railway line or design, because we had no communications. We had for the gunnery side, we had an army radio, but normally speaking, we didn't have any radio in contact with other aircraft. I mean, as soon as they got control going, well, then you had to register your flights. I mean, we used to register flights. We used to ring up where we were going, and we flew safely to find out the weather and everything else, make sure you could land at Brussels and the other airports. But you weren't any flying control like they've got now. Because nowadays you can't do anything. You've got to get all kinds of things beyond radio. It's quite different.
And what about sort of German civil society? Were there people coming out of the woodwork who were
it was all very odd. I mean, generally speaking, you had to be in this. We didn't have very much civilian contact because we were still very much in the army. But this friend of mine who was town major, he had much more contact because he was there to get the trains running, get the telephones going with the help of the Germans. And he said, you know, you gave them the job to do, and they really well did it, and they were damn good at it. And in some of the other countries, I think they were much better than the Italians were, or some of the other places where we were in occupation.
And, Nazis, I mean, Nazis surfacing, people coming out, you know, people who being exposed as being...
Yes, I think so. That was very under control, but I never saw much of that, really. I suppose we didn't want to know. I wasn't really there very long.
Were you waiting for your demob notice, and when that came, was that a relief?
Well, I was 26. I didn't have very long to wait. And then I got my demob and told to go to Aldershot, where I got a civvy suit. And I went into a big hangar there, and all the papers and everything else. Demob. And went into this great hangar. He said, you go in there and you get your clothes. And the chap said, and I said my name, and he looked at this, oh, it's 20. And then he shouted out, 40 Portly! It was my size. 40 Portly. I think if I ever read a book about the army, I'd call it 40 Portly. I didn't think I was very portly.
Too much good living in Germany, perhaps.
So I got a hat, a good raincoat. That was the best part, I think. The suit was all right, shirt. Shoes were quite good too. No, they fitted everybody out of that. And money. That was indeed paying to your bank. And my dear mother, you know, I'd worked at, I said I worked at Sturdivant Air Engineering Company, you know, and when I was at Sutton, recovering from before I went in there, they paid my salary for 18 months when I first went down. My mother opened an account at the post office. Had some money.
Some money waiting. You didn't choose, I mean, you probably could have stayed on as a trained pilot.
Oh, yes. I had various things there. Well, my several of them did do that. Henry Fane, a friend of mine, he became a regular soldier, mainly because he'd got married to an Italian aristocratic girl in Rome and thought it was better, join the army. And he was a major, I think. And but he didn't get sent away anywhere. I think he stayed in... in Germany, and I think he quite enjoyed the life.
But for you, it wasn't an option you wanted to take. You...
No, I know. I was never offered the fact that you want to stay in the army. Well, I suppose that could have been if I'd insisted in the AOP. My wife lived in Cobham, and and she was working. Still there, and she joined while we were at Cambridge. She got interested in crystallography and stuff like that, and she worked in the university with various professors, and she enjoyed that. So when we lived at Cobham, and then we went, and my brother-in-law, we rented a farm, not far from Cambridge. And my wife worked in Cambridge and enjoyed it. So that's where we stayed.
And you didn't go back into the Territorial Army? I mean, that was the end of your service connection, was it?
Yes.
That was quite enough.
I think so, yes. I quite enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I was lucky. Well, then the engineering bit, you see. I was asked to join the Marshalls, which was the EFTS where I was trained. They were after trained RAF people because he was a very bright boy there, Marshall. It's a big company there. And he built a concrete runway because he had friends in the council, the county council. And they were able to land jets, you see. They landed the Comets from Hatfield there, because when the Comet was grounded, it was converted to a spotter plane for the RAF. And they didn't pressurize it, because that was the fault of the Comet 1. It had pressurization problems. And so that the pilots were all on oxygen when they wanted to fly high. And they became the U-2s, the first U-2s. They used to fly all over Europe and Russia, spotting where the Russian radar stuffs were, until the Russians had.
What was your connection with that? I mean, you just worked for Marshalls.
I was an inspector, because I could fly, and I was an inspector. And then we had an assembly plant there. They got a big contract for converting the Vampire T-11. That was the first boom plane. And the RAF wanted to train jet pilots, so they only had that plane and one other jet plane. And but the trouble with the twin boom was it had a difficulty, because they were side by side, the pupil and the instructor. And if they had a flame out, so one of the things they couldn't do that. Unlike a prop plane, if you could start it up again with a crocker, with a jet, if you've got a flame out, you couldn't start them up again. It was very difficult. And so you had to bail out. And they used to lose a lot of instructors, because the plane, if you're not on the controls, the locked controls, certainly, likes to fly straight and narrow the right way up. And had a nasty habit of, once they flipped on their back and dropped the canopy off, and then the pupil dropped out because they had parachutes. But when the instructor tried to get out, very often the plane would start going back the other way, and they had lost several instructors being hit by the boom or the fin and rudder on it. So they decided that they'd have to alter it, but fit injector seats. They didn't have injector seats. And both the Vampire T-11s, Mosquitoes, and the Vixen 5, which was a follow-on from the T-11, they're all balsa and plywood, apart from the wings and the fin and rudders. And so that was a carpenter's job, and the Marshalls were also coach builders. They had a lot of carpenters work there. And what it involved was, in order to get the ejector seat, it's they call it the skate, which is takes the seat up, was a certain height, they had to make the sills higher on the cockpit edge, which was ply and balsam, to fit the new canopy and the seat in. So it involved building that up. And so they had various modifications to do to the plane, so they decided to do, and they had about 400 of these Vampire T-11s to convert for the RAF, because they were the jet plane of the RAF.
So your job was then to work on the production line, inspecting
those? Yeah, inspecting them. First of all, we used to have all the T-11s fly into Cambridge, and we'd strip everything out, all the guts and things, and it's my job to salvage any bits that we could use again. And then I was on the rebuild, tired of it. And every item, I was an inspector and had a stamp to every item, of course, inspected and everything item stamped. So I was working there.
And how long did that continue?
Well, it lasted until 55. And my old boss and the chap I was in the army with, John Atkinson, who was in the 24th, he was running a company at Slough. And he said, I'm after some people to come and work for me. Would you like to come and work for me? And I joined them.
And then again connected with?
Tube Investments, really.
Pardon?
Tube Investments were the owners of the company. And
but it was nothing to do with the services? It was nothing to do with...
No, nothing. It's just I happened to be in the army with him. He was in the 24th
Field. Okay. Well, if there's no service connection, we have to we have to stop the interview, really.
So. No service connection, no.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, thank you. I think we've done...
I hope it's of some interest.
I'm absolutely sure it will be, yes. Especially the Anzio section, that would be a great note. Well, thank you very much, Graham. I'll stop it there.
Not a bit. It was a pleasure.